Welcome to Plymouth Beneath the Surface podcast. Take a deep breath and dive with me into Plymouth waters to meet people such as scientists, students, photographers, divers, and artists that have orientated their lives around the ocean. I'm your host, Louisa Sien, a recent marine biology graduate from the University of Plymouth, and I'm really happy to have you here to listen to some of my conversations with inspiring and passionate people talking about the ocean. So let's get started. Cool, so welcome to this new episode with Claire Amling. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you.
Can I ask you to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Claire Amling. I'm an associate professor in marine ecology and I run the marine biology and oceanography degree.
And what do you do? What's your research or teaching? What do you teach about?
So my focus is on large marine vertebrates. So, and that's the area I've worked in for quite a long time now. I can't count now, but mostly on marine mammals, but also done work on like seabirds and more recently manta rays and that sort of thing. So the large marine vertebrates and seals. So the large marine vertebrates and particularly the ecology of them. So where we find them, why we find them, where they do, where they are, and the sounds that they make as well, and the impacts of noise on them. And yeah, so that's a nutshell of my research.
And what's your career path? Because I know you haven't done marine biology as an undergrad. What has been your journey?
Oh, I have had a really weird wait. I always loved the sea, but I lived in Derbyshire, so which is in the UK is probably the furthest you can get from the sea. But I also always loved going out on the water. But I didn't know what I wanted to do all through. I love nature, so I used to sit in the garden and watch tiny little frogs hatch and the birds, and I used to feed the birds in the garden and just watch them endlessly. But I actually didn't do biology at school because I didn't like the biology teacher, which is really sad. And I really loved maths and science. So I actually ended up going off to university to study electronic engineering. I think partly because I was a bit of a Trekkie, a Star Trek fan. And I just thought, oh, all of that engineering looks really fun. So I went off to do electronic engineering at university. And I kind of enjoyed it, but I knew my heart wasn't in it. I did a really cool project in the final year of how, I'm getting off track a little bit now, but how sounds are produced. There was X-ray images of the vocal canal during speech, and I had to try and extract the contour so that we could be better at making sounds, human sounds. So I think that's the first time I got into sound. But then I worked in a number of different jobs, for example, in radio communications and stuff. But I did conservation work on the side all the time, but I didn't think about swapping careers because I thought, well, I've gone through university and everything, so I'll just do this as a hobby. But then I took 6 months out travelling when I was on just before my third job after university. And the first thing I did, because I was travelling on my own, I just decided to go and do some conservation work. So I went to do some work with Coral Key Conservation in the Philippines, which was absolutely amazing, you know, diving every day and doing surveys of reefs. But I met a girl out there who had done electronic engineering, gone and taught engineering in Singapore, and then fell in love with the sea, and then gone back and done Open University biology, and then a master's, and was now working as a marine scientist for Coral Key Conservation. And I just thought, that's what I want to do. Wow. So that's what I did. I finished traveling and I loved it. I went, you know, around Asia and through Borneo and New Zealand and then back. But, and then I started Open University Biology and that was it. And then I did, managed to get onto a master's at St. Andrews, which was a conversion course for people who'd done like maths or science, but into biology because they wanted more quantitative people. So it was environmental biology conversion course at St. Andrews. And then went straight from there into a PhD because I had the electronic engineering. I went straight from that with the biology as well into doing a PhD, which involved a lot of acoustics. So I had to build my own hydrophones, tow them behind boats, listening for whales and dolphins to find out where they were. And then I did habitat modelling to try and understand why they were found, where they were. And so I went basically straight from my master's into doing that, which was absolutely awesome because I spent 6 months of every year for 3 years just on boats, like lots of different boats, just tying up, towing a hydrophone around, a yacht amongst the Hebrides and survey vessels all around the west coast of Scotland, fishing boats, you know. I was just on one boat after the other, just looking and listening for whales and dolphins and then modelling their distributions with any environmental variables to explain where they were. And that was it. I was converted. I was like, this is awesome.
Wow. And then you moved to Plymouth?
Well, after I did my PhD, I got a postdoc up at University of Aberdeen. Because one of the things I found when I was doing that is the project was with an oceanographer as well at the Scottish Association for Marine Science in Oban. And what we were trying to do is look at the oceanographic drivers of where we found animals. So things like currents and, you know, thermocline, so the depth at which, you know, how the water temperature difference between the top and the bottom of the water because it warms during the summer, that sort of thing, and tides in particular. And I got fascinated by it, especially on the west coast of Scotland. Porpoises there seem to be very driven by the currents, and porpoises are coastal, so they're very driven by the tidal current. So they'd be found feeding more in areas where you'd get more aggregations of fish, which were related to tides. And I got fascinated by that. And I met a woman up in the University of Aberdeen called Beth Scott, who is awesome, really inspirational. And I just got chatting to her while I was doing my PhD and talking about, you know, potentials of doing postdocs. And she was doing work. She did a lot of work on tides and the influence of tides on predator-prey relationships. So we wrote a project together and I went up to work with her looking at predator-prey relationships. But moving on from porpoises, we started looking at, I looked at kittiwakes and we looked at storm petrels and birds that feed at the surface. So the oceanographic processes that go on under the surface can help aggregate food and bring it to the surface. Birds like kittiwakes, they can't dive to get their food. They have to have something that brings the food to the surface to eat. And it's the same with the storm petrels as well, but they're eating plankton. And so it's really important how oceanography can influence that, you know, aggregation of food and bringing up to the surface to be able to feed. So that's what I did in my postdoc at Aberdeen. And then I got a postdoc at the University of Exeter, which was working more on impact of renewable energy, which I just did for a year because then I got the job here at Plymouth. I've kind of glossed over a bit because basically what happened was when I did my PhD, I went to a conference on whales and dolphins in Sweden in my first year of my PhD, actually. And that's where I met my husband now, Simon. And so after that, we were juggling. He was working in Ireland and I was working in the UK. And then when I got the postdoc in Aberdeen, he happened to get a postdoc in Aberdeen as well, though he was based up in the Cromartie Field Station, which is actually 4 hours away from Aberdeen itself. So it was a little bit of... But then he got the job down in Plymouth. When I was finishing off my postdoc at Aberdeen, was like doing a week every month up in Aberdeen and the rest down in Plymouth. And then when I got the postdoc at Exeter, that was actually, I had a small baby then because I had children in the middle as well. Then I was just doing one day a week at Exeter because they were very good at... Both times have been really good at supporting families. And then I was like, well, I want to lectureship at Plymouth with Simon as well. So I got there eventually.
It's funny, like what you were saying, being on the boats that often when you were doing your PhD, because one of my questions was going to be like, you know, when people think of people or like scientists studying cetaceans, they imagine them, you know, on boats all the time with a pair of binoculars. Is that really true? But then it looks like your PhD was really true.
That was my PhD, but I wanted a field-based PhD. That was one of my focus. All I knew was, for a PhD, actually, I would have been happy. I know this, I mean, like, I'm surrounded by people who are obsessed by marine biology, and I love marine biology, but I love biology generally. So when I went off to do environmental biology at a master's, I would have happily worked on mycorrhizal fungi and trees, because I think that's fascinating how trees will talk through mycorrhizal fungi. I just wanted to do something ecology based, so I just fell into marine biology. But one thing I did know is I didn't want to do lab work. I wanted to be out. I wanted to be a field biologist. And so I wanted to do a PhD where I was in the field a lot. And with my sort of background, I could have easily fallen into an analysis PhD. And I love doing analysis, so I'm quite happy doing that. But at the time, because I hadn't done a biology degree, I wanted to get out there and get the field skills. So I was kind of like, in my mind, I was like, I want to do a project that's going to involve some chunky analysis, but also a lot of field biology. But that's not to say you have to do cetacean studies, because there are, for example, if you were working on PhDs, for example, in the Antarctic or whatever, you might not spend like, you know, huge amounts of time in the Antarctic. You could be analysing large amounts of data. Or, for example, there's PhDs where you're looking at cool satellite data, identifying whales from space. You won't be doing any, well, you might do some validation perhaps in the field, but it could be quite quantitative. So you don't have to be sitting there on a boat all the time. That's just what I wanted to do. So
I wouldn't complain either. It's pretty cool.
So I was primarily focusing on listening for whales. Now, in the Hebrides, when I was doing the watches, we were doing the yachts, we were doing visual and acoustics. But offshore, you know, where the conditions are pretty rough, it takes a lot of time and you need more than one person to be watching all the time. And to be honest, you can hear them a lot better than you can see them most of the time. And even for porpoises, for example, even in coastal waters, you know, if you're doing watches, porpoises are really shy, small little creatures. They don't make a big splash. They're not like, hey, look at me, like some of the other dolphins. They just roll through the water gently and they're only seen usually in one or two, maybe three at a time. So if the sea conditions are more than a like, you know, once you get white horses, then they're really difficult to see. And they're still quite difficult to see even when it's a little bit choppy. But they vocalise nearly continuously. They make very high frequency, so we can't hear them. So if you go in the water with a porpoise, you won't hear them. They make sounds well above our hearing, 140 kilohertz, roughly. But with a hydrophone, we can hear them. And you can hear them. I mean, on the west coast of Scotland, I heard them three times more than I could see them. Now, if it's mirror calm conditions, you can see them better than you can hear them, because you can only hear them up to about 500 metres, if you're lucky, maybe 300 metres. Whereas if you've got flat, calm conditions, you can see them for much further. So, but most of the time the sea isn't like that. So you can hear them much better than you can see them. And even now we do cetacean surveys off the southwest coast, particularly off like Cornwall. I had a student who worked up the data, and we're doing visual watches continuously, recording all the cetaceans that we see, as well as seabirds and anything else we see, like sunfish and sharks. But I had a student who looked at the acoustics, and I think it was five times more porpoises that she detected using the acoustics than you do visually, so it's much better. And then offshore, I did a lot of work on sperm whales, and again, they vocalise mostly continuously. This kind of metronome sound, and you can hear that with your ear. You know, they're diving for like maybe an hour at a time, but then they're only at the surface for, you know, 9 minutes max, really. And then they're just, you know, they're just at the top. They're not like leaping around, or they're just there gathering their breath to take another dive. So you can hear them quite far. So it's really good for sperm whales as well. So I did quite a lot of work on sperm whales off the west coast of Scotland as well.
Why do cetaceans use, or like, why do they click, or why do they vocalise that much for people maybe that haven't been in your lectures yet?
Yeah, so, well, one of the really good reasons is the fact that if you're a deep diving whale, so this doesn't really count for like porpoises or coastal dolphins, whatever, then it's really dark, you know. The light doesn't penetrate that far down. And say, for example, a sperm whale who's diving, you know, I mean, often they'll dive down to 400 metres. There's a kind of like a layer of lots of food about 400 metres called the mesopelagic layer, but often even deeper. And then another species, beaked whales, they've been recorded diving down over 3,000 metres. It's dark down there. So they're using sound to be able to navigate, but also find their food. And sperm whales are built for sound. I mean, they are the ultimate. I mean, I'm a bit of a sperm whale fan. But sperm whales are built for sound. a third of their heads are just for making sounds, and they make the sound loudest sound of all animal probably anywhere in the planet. Probably somebody's going to go, well, actually, a snapping shrimp. They can stun their prey. But yeah, really, really loud sound. So they use a third of their body, which is their head, to make this sound, just kind of like they bounce it around in their head and then it goes out. And it's really, really, really loud. And it allows them to catch very large squid. And they're just awesome. So that's one of the reasons that the animals use echolocation, is to find food in the dark. And it means they can feed at night as well. The other reason is that sound travels 5 times faster in water than in air. So it's a really good way of finding food as well. So that's what the clicks are. That's for them finding food. Though some species, like sperm whales, also use them for communication and socialising, which is also quite cool. So like a little bit like Morse code, they will use a series of clicks to say, I'm this clan. They're clans. Somebody Scottish must have thought of that, but... sperm whales are in these groups called clans, and they tend to hang out together, and you can identify them, and they've done it with genetics now as well, and the ones from a group will all have the same like series of clicks, like click click click, you know,
same
a coder, it's called a coder. Yeah. And they're just going around going, so you know, if my surname's Embling, so I'm like Embling Embling. And then you'd be going, well,
De Lyon,
De Lyon, De Lyon. Except there's fewer groups. So so some animals have been shown to use clicks for communication as well, but mostly it's for finding food and navigating. And then like river dolphins as well, who are also pretty awesome at finding food and echolocating, though they produce whistles as well. They're a lot of those are functionally blind because the rivers are just so murky. That they're using echolocation is incredibly important for them to find their food. So yeah, they're quite cool. But then obviously there's whistles as well, and that's just a socialising kind of... So all the... Going to get into technical terms, but the toothed whales, all the ones with teeth as opposed to baleen, so your dolphins, your killer whales... your pilot whales, all that
sperm
sort of
whale.
Thing. And the sperm whale, yeah, but sperm whales are a bit... Yeah. So they're all toothed whales, and sperm whales are, and so are porpoises, but most toothed whales and dolphins, well, they're all under toothed whales, produce whistles as well, except okay. for porpoises and for sperm whales.
Okay.
Yeah. And the whistles are for communicating. So, for example, bottlenose dolphins have got this signature whistle. And instead of, you know, sperm whales, I said, they've got a family name, which is this kind of like series of clicks and clicks. Well, dolphins have got individual names, signature whistles. So they've got unique whistles for each dolphin. So instead they go around going, I'll be going around going, Claire, 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 Claire. They're very self-absorbed dolphins.
Is that what Emma Longdon did for her station?
Yeah. So because each individual dolphin can have a name, if you... you know, this signature whistle, and you can identify those signature whistles because they just keep repeatedly saying them, then you can actually count the number. And that was really, really new, because normally you use photo identification. So the markings on a dorsal fin, for example, for a bottlenose dolphin, look at the scarring, you know, the marking on a dorsal fin to be able to identify individuals. But now we've been with Emma, dissertation student from here, from Plymouth, her paper showed that you could use signature whistles to count how many dolphins there are, because that's really important for conservation. And the population she was working on in Namibia is only, what, I think it was 70, 80 dolphins. That's a really small population. So you need to, and it's coastal, so you need to really protect those populations, because they're really, you know, they're really confined and really subject to any human disturbance that you're doing in these coastal areas. So understanding how many are there is really important to be able to know whether they're increasing or decreasing. And you can use whistles now for doing that, which is quite cool.
What sort of species do we have around the southwest?
Well, last weekend there was a humpback whale. Actually, humpback whale, so I shouldn't start with humpback whales. The most common species is porpoises, the harbour porpoise. So we've got lots of harbour porpoises. Many people might not have noticed them before because they are quite shy, but they're kind of like quite small. They're only like 1.6 metres long. So like a short person like me. And they just really small, just roll through the water and got quite a small dorsal fin. Then we've got bottlenose dolphins in the southwest, but quite a small population. So we've got, there's two types of bottlenose dolphins. There's the coastal bottlenose dolphins, which are a bit smaller, and then there's the offshore bottlenose dolphins, which tend to be in, there's many more of those, and they live mostly offshore, but you do see them coastally, but they're a bigger bottlenose dolphin. Now, the coastal population of bottlenose dolphins in the southwest is, I keep losing track of how many there are, but there's only a small number, under 40, I think, on the last calculation, which is a really small number. And they range quite widely around Cornwall and Devon. We're quite worried about that population because it's been declining over time as well. So you might see bottlenose dolphins. They pop up randomly in different places, generally in group of 10 or so. And then we've got common dolphins. So the ones that have been spotted a lot in Plymouth Sound recently are common dolphins. They're the ones with the kind of like beautiful creamy markings along the side. I call it an hourglass because it's kind of like, but anyway, they've got these beautiful markings along the side. They're smaller than a bottlenose dolphin. You tend to see them in relatively large, sometimes you can see them in massive schools, though I haven't seen that in Plymouth Sound, but like thousands of dolphins all together. But not in Plymouth Sound, smaller groups. I don't know how big, 10, 20 dolphins?
Yeah, last time that I saw them, they were like about 20.
And they're 10, really, 12. They love bow riding and
they're really playful.
So they're quite common, obviously, because they're called the common dolphin. Yeah, and last weekend there was a baby humpback whale in Plymouth Sound, which is the first time in, I don't know, I'd have to go through the records to see when it was last seen in Plymouth Sound. We have been having more sightings of humpback whales on the southwest over the years, and it's probably a good sign. It probably means the humpback whales are doing a lot better.
Or is it
bouncing back from whaling?
Okay, so it is seen as a good sign rather than, like, I don't know, water getting warmer or...
Yeah, it's difficult to know. You know, when there's only a few sightings, it's difficult to be able to say with certainty. But I think most scientists are quite positive. We think it means that the populations are doing a lot better, and that's why we're seeing them more. But yeah, everything's interlinked, so it's difficult to know whether we're seeing them more also because of warming seas and changing climate. But yeah, it seems to be a regular occurrence now that juvenile humpback whales are seen in the southwest nearly every year now in the summer.
Okay, cool.
But this baby whale seen in Plymouth Sound looks very young, so I think I'm a bit worried about it. But fingers crossed. What other species do we get? So we get all sorts of, Risso's dolphins. They're a chunky, decent-sized dolphin, quite kind of like white and kind of like scratchy marks all over them, which gets more as they get older. You don't tend to see them in large schools. They tend to be in relatively small ones, relatively shy, though I have had them bow riding before. But minke whales. Why didn't I say minke whales?
I was waiting for it. I'm testing you.
Minke whales. Yeah, so we've got minke whales as well, frequently seen along the south coast. So they're a baleen whale, and they're mostly eating the small fish, sand eels and sprat along our coast.
Any orcas?
There have been this year, haven't there? So I the first time, do you know, I worked off the west coast of Scotland for quite a few years. I can't remember how many years. And they've got loads of orca up there, but I never saw them. They were always seen the day after I was there. And then the first time I saw them was off Cornwall, in fact. But this year, the orca, there's one called Junko. He's a male and he's got a kind of like a floppy fin. And he seems to be just circling the UK this year.
Just going around.
Yeah. So we've seen off Cornwall and then he was seen back up in Scotland. And then he was seen in the Channel again. That group of killer whales are circling a bit. So we've got different types of killer whales around the UK. We've got some kind of like mammal eating killer whales, mostly found in Shetland sort of area. They're like feasting on the little baby common seals. So Shetland in June is a good time to see those ones. And then we've got a lot of fish eating killer whales as well. I think John Coe and Co are kind of mixed. They'll eat whatever's available.
And what are the main threats to cetaceans? Maybe not globally, because I think it's really like context dependent, or like it depends on where, but if we look at the Channel or like England, the UK and the southwest, what would you say? are the main threats.
Bycatch is the main threat. And that's probably globally, actually. I mean, even if you think about like species that are on the verge of extinction, it's bycatch, again, like the vaquita. But in the southwest, it's still bycatch. In fact, the southwest has got one of the highest bycatch problems in the UK. So for porpoises and common dolphins, primarily, there's a lot of entanglement issues with seals in the southwest as well. So with fishing gear, that is the main threat that we need to try and manage. Obviously, the channel also is very noisy. So there's a lot and lot of ships and boats and recreational craft and everything. But I'd still say bycatch is the major one because it's catching. The cetaceans have been caught in nets and then dying, which is very concerning.
What could be done?
So there's a lot of work being done on this by quite a few of my colleagues. So one of the ways in which they try and reduce it is by having pingers on nets, which scares animals. Now, okay, it's producing noise pollution, but it's the risk of noise pollution against catching a dolphin. So it's disturbance versus death, okay? So having pingers on nets can scare away animals, which means that you get less bycatch. So that's one of the main things. And for example, in the southwest, that's one of the main ways in UK waters in which we're trying to reduce bycatch is having pingers on nets. You can have kind of like designs of nets to reduce bycatch or having escape hatches. I think the primary way in which we people are trying to do it is through pingers, but there are, you know, you can try and design alternative nets that don't catch so many dolphins or let them escape. And then an obvious one is obviously, you know, trying to do some sort of spatial management and spatial and temporal management is trying to understand where the animals are, when they're feeding, when the overlap is happening, and then try and reduce it. It is hard. When I was doing some surveys in the Celtic Sea, and I was trying to look at the predator-prey interactions that I was talking about with oceanography driving predator-prey interactions, we did a lot of bird observations and cetacean observations, and I also had some hydrophones. But the only time we saw cetaceans was following fishing boats. So I think it's going to be difficult because if the dolphins are following the fishing boats, it's going to be difficult for them to, I mean, and the fishing boat's probably there when the fish are there. And so it's nice to say, let's spatially manage this area, find out where the areas are with the fish, and let the dolphins eat them when they want to eat them. And then the fishermen can go a different time. But I don't think it's probably quite that simple. Mm. So, but maybe other fishing methods or, you know, definitely the pingers to try and help. It's just a really difficult one.
It's really difficult. Do you think any sort of marine protected area would help?
If you could identify an area that was persistently used over time for feeding and was important for those animals, then potentially, yeah. Common dolphins do range over, I mean, and porpoises, I've done habitat modelling of them and they do tend to use some areas more than others, but they're very wide ranging and they're using a lot of different areas. So it might be quite difficult to identify like a single place that, you know, would be important to protect. But it's probably something, you know, we need to do. I don't think we've got that sort of information, for example, for the southwest, is knowing, you know, where exactly all the dolphins and porpoises are and where their feeding areas are and whether they change over time to mean that we could define an area that we could protect. We just don't have that sort of information. We need regular surveys to understand where they are and then be able to try and identify some of those sites that might be important. And then obviously with climate change, these sites might change over time anyway. But I mean, there are some key sites, for example, shelf edges are always important. So it's possible that, you know, that's important for fishermen as well. So,
yeah.
But yes, potentially. But I mean, off the top of my head, in the southwest, I couldn't identify a single location that would be an ideal spot, perhaps for a marine protected area to protect them against bycatch.
So do you think we need more data and more research on?
Yeah.
On them? Loads of people want to do that sort of work. Is it because of lack of funding rather than a lack of people?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we just need more funding. I mean, there is a lot of people trying to tackle the bycatch problem, but still we have a very little amount of information, you know, about where the animals are. So more survey work, definitely needed. But you don't want to wait until that information is available either. You need to do something now. And a lot of people are doing things now and trying to. But there's also a lot of, because I'm thinking about the channel, and obviously a lot of that is not just UK waters, it's French waters as well. So trying to get something that you can get working across boundaries as well. And also when you've got fishing boats coming in from other jurisdictions to fish in their waters as well, then it makes it a lot more difficult to manage. And I think the legislation also is pingers on boats over 12 metres. But, you know, you can still get bycatch on smaller boats as well. So,
yeah.
So legislation can drive it.
Is there enforcement for the pingers? Because I know there isn't in France, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know how much checking. Must admit, I don't know.
And when you were talking about surveys, can you tell us about the Mayflower autonomous ship? I know you were like it.
Yeah, so that's quite a cool project that I've been involved with recently. Mayflower is an autonomous ship that's supposed to be repeating the original Mayflower journey. So taking
the... So leaving from Plymouth.
Yeah, so leaving from Plymouth. So the Mayflower did originally leave from Plymouth and take, 100 people over to America, to Plymouth. So it's going to be repeating, well, not exactly the same route. We'll pick the route that's appropriate for the weather, but repeating that journey of Plymouth to Plymouth. So Plymouth, UK and Plymouth, US. But it's not taking any people. It's a robotic ship. So the Mayflower autonomous ship is totally autonomous. So a lot of autonomous ships so far, they're like more like remote controls, you know, kind of like move it a bit to the left and move it to that. This one's got automatic ways of detecting ships and avoiding ships, but it's also equipped with lots of scientific equipment. So it's got something called hypertaste, which just tastes the water. So basically it's measuring
salinity
and pH and temperature, but also metals in the water and stuff like that. It's got a holocam on board, so it's collecting. It's taking photographs of plankton as we're going across. How cool.
Where is that project from? Is it like a UK project? Is it a Plymouth project? Is it?
Yeah, it's kind of multinational. So we're working with people from America. We're working with IBM. We're working with Promare, which also has... We're working with people in Norway.
That's amazing.
And MSubs. And yeah, so there's a lot of people involved. But yeah, obviously it's got a hydrophone on board as well. So that's where I'm involved. So it's got a hydrophone attached to it. It's also got loads of cameras, so you can watch it online to be able to see. I was watching it going, can I see any dolphins?
I'll definitely look at it.
It did have some barrow-riding dolphins at one point, but... so it's listening for whales. And also we've been working with IBM to do machine learning. So we've basically over the past maybe nearly a year now, maybe not quite a year, I've been using recordings and working with RS Aqua as well, who provided the hydrophone. I've been providing this system with sounds of different whales and dolphins to train computer recognition. So we just kind of like feed them. And then this amazing person in IBM in America, she came up with one where, we don't have enough sounds to train the model. So she's designed something that mimics whale and dolphin sounds to produce a bigger amount of sounds to train the model, which is quite cool. So we're waiting on the first set of data now to find out how well it's working at the moment. So it did set sail and it got beyond the shelf edge, but it had some technical difficulties, so it had to come back. But it's going to set sail again. I say set sail, it hasn't got any sails.
Yeah, how big is it?
Maybe 3 meters long, I'm guessing. Three, maybe four. No, maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's five. It's about the size of my office.
When is it going to leave?
Yeah, we don't know when it's going to leave again, because it's very... So they've been doing all the fixing, because there was one component that failed, which is really annoying. But it's better to retrieve it than...
Will you leave from Plymouth Sound?
Yeah.
Can we see it leaving as well?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So it's got live video feeds and then it feeds back other information as well. So hopefully next time it's set sail, we'll manage to get across to Plymouth. To Plymouth, yeah. Nice. With all that data, because it's collecting other data as well. So it'd be quite nice to be able to link through, if we hear whales and dolphins, through to, you know, some of the measurements that they're taking of the environment and then maybe through to plankton and stuff like that. So we just have to wait and see.
To wrap it up, do you have any tips or advice to, you know, anyone that would love to study whales and cetaceans and do conservation work? Or just do marine biology?
I mean, the first thing I would say is just follow your passion and do what you love. So that's an easy one to say. You're like, oh yeah, whatever, but no, that's worked for me. So I would say, firstly, follow your passion, do what you love. So if you're kind of like thinking of two different paths and you're thinking, well, I could get that, do that, but I don't like it as much, always follow the thing that you love the most and you'll be good at it. I would say alongside, obviously, it's not an easy career to get into. There's lots of people who want to work on whales and dolphins or, you know, marine mammals and that sort of thing. Try and also get a range of skills to stand out from the crowd. So if you happen to be quite good at analysis techniques, then milk it, you know, make sure you learn all those analysis techniques, you know, for being able to analyse data. But maybe your skills line is slightly different area. So I would say, you know, do what you love, but then also expand your skill set, whether that's through doing statistical analysis or lab skills or, you know, GIS, you know, mapping or whatever, then you've got extra feathers to your bow, so to speak. And then, yeah, just believe in yourself, really, because it'll be up and down. It always is. I mean, I nearly quit during my first year of my PhD just because I was like, I can't do this, it's too hard. And then went to a conference and met loads of other people and got re-inspired.
And met Simon.
Well, yeah, that kind of helped too. Yeah, so sometimes it can be a bit tough along route, but, you know, if you just keep doing what you love and be nice to people too, because networks are quite important and it's nice to be nice.
Thanks for listening to Claire and I, and I hope you enjoyed this episode and learned a bit more about cetaceans in general and cetaceans in the southwest. I don't think realise how many species we have in British waters, and that we don't need to go to, you know, the other side of the world to see dolphins or whales, and that we're really lucky, but also we really need to protect them. So I've put more information in the description as usual for you to check out, and yeah, I'm looking forward to the next episode. Thanks for being part of this journey with me.